Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Hollywood filmmaker Barry Sonnenfeld's new book and present an interview with Barry Sonnenfeld. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, tell me about this book. What is the name of this book, first of all?
The name of this book is Best Possible Place, Worst Possible Time, True Stories from a Career in Hollywood. Sounds like a pretty innocuous title for a collection of memoirs from a director like Barry Sonnenfeld, who has done everything from the two live-action Addams Family movies to the first three Men in Black movies and Get Shorty and working as a director of photography for the Coen brothers and their early works like Blood Simple and Raising Arizona. But the origin of the title, once you actually find out what it is, which you will in my interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, because I wanted him to tell this anecdote to our listeners, is hilarious. And it involves Tommy Lee Jones on the set of Men in Black. So you'll find out about that once you hear our full interview.
Amazing. Yeah, you got quite a lot of time with him. So we're not going to spend a ton of time in the intro here, but I have not had a chance to read this book yet. But I would love for you to make the case to our listeners for why they should read it, because obviously you read it before talking with Barry for this interview.
Yeah, so I think you'll find that a lot of memoirs out there really feel like they dig into so much of like personal thoughts and like really looking back on things in an extremely like retrospective way that like almost feels like it's trying to just like explain everything about where they were in that moment in time and really like provide this like almost like biographical account of their own life from their own perspective. This book is more like a collection of anecdotes. And as Barry describes it in our interview, where they said the publisher kind of wanted him to write a book with a collection of stories that people could easily read on the toilet and just read a little bit and then move on. And they're very brisk. I wouldn't even necessarily call them chapters, but like they're all separated into different stories and everything. Some of them are as short as like one page, some of them are a few pages, but they're all very breezy. It's a super quick read, but it's so fascinating to hear him talk about working on all these things. He has some pretty great relatively scathing stories about working with Gene Hackman and John Travolta on Get Shorty, talking about the complications of working on big movies with a lot of hands in the pot on Men in Black. He gets very honest about the things that went wrong with Men in Black 2 and Wild Wild West, the two movies that he considers his biggest disappointments, and flat out says in the book that his career never really recovered from them. He talks about almost doing Forrest Gump and why that didn't work out, why he didn't make a movie with Jim Carrey. There's so many fascinating stories in this book. Like, I couldn't put it down. I read through it so quickly. And the other thing that I didn't know about Barry Sonnenfeld before reading this book is he's hilarious. All of these stories in here feel like they're like actually like polished written bits from like a stand-up comedian. Like he has great timing even in the writing of these stories, the way he begins and ends them. Sometimes he ends them on like a perfect punchline. He's just a really good storyteller and a really good writer. So if you are interested at all in any of the movies he's made over the years, or you just want, you know, some good laughs and find out some really intriguing stories about working with some of these big Hollywood stars, I could not recommend more reading this book.
Amazing. That's a great pitch. Also, yeah, for people who, again, like you've named some pretty high profile stuff that he's directed, but he also directed The Tick, or some of the TV show The Tick, Pushing Daisies. He's a director and executive producer on Schmigadoon. I mean, he's been like all over the place in film and TV for the past, what, like 30 something years or something, maybe even a little longer at this point.
And one of the cool things that we talk about that he has not talked about at all in either of his books, his first book is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, which doubles as more of like a life retrospective about like his parents and his childhood and how he became a filmmaker and some of his other work here and there. But this one is a lot more Hollywood focused. But the thing that I got to talk to him about in our interview that he doesn't mention in either one is what happened with the Beverly Hills Cop TV series that didn't get picked up, but he directed the pilot for, with Brandon T. Jackson from Tropic Thunder playing Axel Foley's son and Eddie Murphy reprising the role of Axel Foley. So you get to find out what happened with that series and why it never moved ahead.
Excellent. Okay. Well, yeah, man, that's a great intro, great tease. I think let's actually take a break and then we'll come back and present your interview with Barry Sonnenfeld.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details. Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Okay, before we get into it, we should mention that there was a little recording mix-up at the beginning of this interview. So for the first 5 minutes or so of this 30-plus minute-long discussion, you'll hear Brad's backup recording, and then you'll hear a noticeable improvement in the quality immediately after that for the rest of their conversation. So sorry about that, but at least we didn't lose the audio entirely, which has happened before and is always horrifying. So without further ado, here is Brad's conversation with Barry Sonnenfeld.
So Barry, I've loved so many of your films over the years. You know, I grew up with Adam's Family, Men in Black, but I never realized until reading your books that you were just an inherently funny person. Your stories read like the polished bits of a stand-up comedian with of a one-man show comprised of this incredible wealth of Hollywood anecdotes.
Oh, thanks so much.
Why did it take so long for you to share, you know, this gift with us?
Well, the gift was actually shared in March of 2020 when I dropped my first book,
right,
which is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, which is something that happened to me at Madison Square Garden when my mother paged me at 2:20 in the morning. So I wrote a book that was published in March of 2020, days before the pandemic shut us down. My publisher really liked the book, and then they said, and that book was really about my parents and my upbringing in right. Washington Heights and how I ended up becoming a filmmaker. But then Hachette, my publisher, wanted a second book that's specific to my career. So they said, the editor said, give me short chapters that people could read on the toilet. So depending on how constipated you are or aren't, some of those chapters are readable on the toilet.
Yeah. Since working with the Coen brothers is like your earliest Hollywood work, I was wondering if there was anything key you learned from them as filmmakers that you took to your directorial debut with Adam's Family, and how you combined that with your own filmmaking sensibilities.
Right. Well, Joel, Ethan, and I are good friends. And I think that I would say that we all shared a very similar way of working in that, you know, the three of us, first of all, Joel Coen went to undergraduate NYU film school. I went to the graduate film school. I didn't know him there. But one thing you learn at film school is everything is about pre-production. So Joel, Ethan, and I are just crazy nuts about pre-production. Every shot is worked out. In my case, both as a cameraman and now as a director, I design all the shots. I publish them so the crew, both at the beginning of the movie, then weekly, then daily, get a list of every shot we're going to do.
Yeah.
And what that does is it really helps you make movies less expensively, said the guy who's made $100 million movies in budget. In that, you know, the grip, the key grip would come to me and say, when you write boom up, is that a dolly boom or do we need a crane? Or so everything is worked out. Right. I hate, and so do the Coens, I'm sure, being on the set and not knowing where to put the camera for the next shot.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than looking out the window and seeing your crew playing Frisbee or laying in the sun on sound blankets, you know, while you try to figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
So I think what the Coens and I also learned together is how much we like sort of self-conscious camera, you know, whether it's, in my case, you know, as a cameraman, I'm Blood Simple or Raising Arizona or Throw Mama from the Train or 3 o'clock High. And then as a director on Adam's Family and the Men in Black movies, I really like to move the camera a lot and make sure that the camera is more than a recording device. It's a right. storytelling device.
Now, working with the Coen brothers, I'm sure, was a far different experience than your earlier work behind a camera, which was on adult films, as you hilariously recount in your first book. But I imagine you probably learned a lot during that time, too, that probably helped shape, you know, what you would eventually do as a cinematographer and a director.
Well, you know, I've always been a wide-angle lens guy. And one of the things I learned working on pornos is that if you're going to still shoot with a wide angle lens, especially inserts, you're going to be way too close to penises, vaginas, and assholes. And I learned the hard way that you should really use a longer lens and be a little further back from the action, because as I recount in painful detail in chapter 19, called A Actor Short, A Cum Shot Behind, on Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, I recount how the last day of shooting, I ended up being covered in human excrement when a fountain of liquefied fecal matter shoots out of this woman's rectum and ends up all over my camera and my face, at which point I threw up on her. And then ruining the shot, let's face it, as if the fountain of excrement wasn't enough to ruin the shot. I then ran to the elevator, went down to the lobby. We were shooting at a loft on 17th and 5th, and stood in the pouring rain looking like Willem Dafoe at the end of Platoon, trying to allow, you know, with my arms outstretched, trying to get the rain to wash the vomit and fecal matter off of my face and clothing and shoes. It was a nightmare. So what I learned shooting pornos is, if you're shooting pornos, use a longer lens. If you're not shooting pornos, here's my philosophy. Wide angle lenses are funny. Telephoto lenses are sort of much more handsome because the background goes out of focus and you can get the lights more much closer to your subject. But they're not funny.
There you go. Now, you make it politely clear in your book that you weren't super thrilled that Kevin Smith took that story you just told and used it for Zach and Miri Make a Porno. Interestingly enough, Kevin Smith also has a story about how John Peters was obsessed with having Superman fight a giant spider in a movie that never came to fruition. But that giant spider eventually made it into Wild Wild West. Was that something that John Peters forced you to include in that movie?
John Peters was insistent on two things. A giant spider, and I think we executed it well, but made it way too big in scale.
Okay.
And I think it took the audience out of the movie. There were many things wrong with that movie. That was one of them. The bigger issue that was a John Peters' total insistence on that kind of helped ruin the movie was John Peters insisted that that Will Smith be in drag.
Of course.
And that scene is so horrible. And it was so expensive, and we had to build this giant set for it. Will didn't want to do it. I didn't want it done. And it was just one of the many reasons that Wild Wild West is one of my least favorite movies as a director.
Yeah, you also talk about how the dynamic between Kevin Kline and Will Smith didn't work out very well because Kevin felt like he needed to try to be funny, and that was supposed to be Will Smith's job. Do you think that that dynamic probably would have worked better if George Clooney had ended up signing on to the movie as was originally intended?
Absolutely, because George Clooney can be a great straight man. He's a great reactor. And as you know, comedies always play out in reaction shots. I was a cinematographer on When Harry Met Sally, and as funny as Meg Ryan is faking an orgasm, you cut to Billy doing nothing but chewing his corned beef sandwich, staring at her, and the laughs go from 80 dBs to 100 dBs because the reaction shot is the audience's point of view. So you always want a very flat reaction shot. The best way to play comedies actually is in two shots, action and reaction in the same frame. Cary Grant wearing Katharine Hepburn's aunt's bathrobe, while Katharine Hepburn is calling Cary Grant Mr. Bones, which is not his name. And the hilarity is Cary Grant just trying to get a word in edgewise, Katharine Hepburn going on and on with this nonsense. And you look at all those old screwball comedies, Preston Sturges, there's very little cutting. And I always say cutting to the close-up for a punchline is the enemy of comedy. The more you can play comedy out in two shots, wide shots, with fewer editing, it's why I always try to pace the actors to talk fast, as you read. I mentioned that a lot, because then the pace is controlled in the shooting and you don't have to edit to control pace. So for me, the more you can pace, have a faster pace on the set, the better your comedy will be.
I wanted to jump back to Adam's Family because you mentioned in the book that several actors had passed on the role of Uncle Fester before Christopher Lloyd came along, and I was curious about who some of those other actors might have been.
Right. I'm trying to remember his last name, and you'll help me. He's a British comedian named Robbie, big guy,
Robbie Coltrane.
Robbie Coltrane. We had a meeting. Scott Rudin and I had a meeting with Robbie at a Chinese restaurant in New York City called Shanghai, Shun Li West. And A, he ate a lot. B, he talked really loud. And three, every third word. And I admit that the Brits use it differently than us Americans do, was the word cunt. Everything was a cunt. Everyone was a cunt. And it just, and Rudin and I had just, and we were having lunch there, which means we're eating with the matinee crowd of the people about to go to the Met for the afternoon, opera. So it's us three and then 800, 80-year-old women with white hair, and it was tough. So, but luckily he passed. I'm trying to remember. We went with a bunch of sort of bigger guys, physically more Fester-like. And the funny thing is, you would never think of Chris Lloyd as that guy to play Uncle Fester. He's thin, he's lithe, and in fact, I would watch takes in the cutting room. In the editing room, and Chris would be tall and thin. And I go, oh my God, this won't work. And then I hear myself say action, and his head would disappear into his shoulders. He'd lose his neck, and he was amazing. I'll tell you a story about Chris. So, because we were worried that Chris wasn't going to look enough like Uncle Fester, we decided to give him. See what he would look like with prosthetics. So, Alan Munro, who was our visual effects supervisor, arranged to give him a prosthetic face. We shot an actual scene with Chris on a real set and everything, and he looked like a character from Dick Tracy, Which was a great movie, but everyone looked like that. So he was that, those people were within that world.
Right.
But the test we shot, Chris looked like literally he walked off of a Warren Beatty's movie. So we arranged for Chris to come because Chris really wanted to disappear in the role. So he was really excited about prosthetics. So we arranged for Chris to come to Paramount. We arranged for a screening room for Scott Rudin and I to show him the test so he could see how he looked like he was from a different movie. Chris shows up, unbeknownst to us, the same day in the same building, our cinematographer, Owen Roizman, was interviewing stand-ins for Fester. So Chris walks into the building and sees a bunch of chairs with a bunch of sort of rotund men sitting there. And all Chris knows is he's been called to see his test
right.
in the screening room at Paramount, right? So Chris comes in. I show him the test. And I say, so, Chris, what do you think? And in fact, I should have put this in the book. Now I realize I missed the golden opportunity for yet another toilet hilarity chapter. So anyway, I say, Chris, what do you think? And Chris says, well, it was, I thought it was just a test. I promise I can do better. I just thought it was a test. And I swear my acting can improve. And I go, I don't care about the acting. What do you think about the prosthetics? Because Scott and I don't think it's working. And Chris says, well, if you're not worried about my acting, why do you have all those other festers downstairs to be interviewed? And then I found out that Owen was, but anyway, that's how adorably sort of how lovely Chris was that he thought I had called him over to torture him to show him how bad his acting was in the test. And he agreed that it was wrong. But boy, the time between roll camera and action, Chris every day transformed into Fester.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And the funny thing is I had a big realization when I was a kid because I loved Back to the Future growing up too. And I didn't realize until I was a bit older that Christopher Lloyd was both Doc Brown and Uncle Fester. It just never registered.
Ah, of course not.
And so when I had that realization, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah. No, Chris is, he was also in the pilot of The Tick, the original Tick that
right.
I did with Patrick Warburton. And he played the Rabbit Man's, David Burke's boss who fires him. But Chris is lovely.
So moving on to Addams Family Values, I was so interested to hear about the music video that Never Came to Be from Michael Jackson for this movie. And that would go on to actually be his own music video with a song called Ghosts. I was curious if you were involved in the actual development of the video's concept at all, especially since it included footage of the Addams Family children at the end of it.
I've never seen this video. It's called Ghosts.
Yeah, so there's somehow the footage that they shot for this music video for Addams Family Values leaked online. The concept itself, he ended up reusing for a song called Ghosts, and it's pretty much the exact same premise, setting, everything, but just without the Addams Family kids appearing at the end.
I am fascinated by that. That's such interesting information. So here's what happened. On Addams Family, we were lucky enough to have MC Hammer write a really great song for the end credits of Addams Family. We love the song.
Yeah.
So when we did Addams Family Values, we thought, why not get an even bigger star? We wrongly thought, why not get an even bigger star? Let's get Michael Jackson. So we spoke to his, you know, people. And it was arranged that Scott Rudin and I would drive out to the Neverland Ranch in separate cars because I didn't want to drive with Scott. He didn't want to drive with me. So we both drive way out to like Santa Ynez or Paso Robles, wherever that place is. We get there and there's no Michael Jackson. We've got the reels of film. And his estate manager says, oh, Michael's been delayed, but he'll be here soon.
Right.
Soon was like somewhere between 4 and 6 hours later. So Scott and I give the projectionist the film, and we're sitting in the screening room, assuming it will just be a short amount of time, and then he'll be up and we'll meet him and he'll see the movie and then decide if he's going to do a song or not. I am so interested. I got to listen to Ghost. So anyway, Rudin keeps falling asleep and snoring, and I'm in this weird screening room that has bedrooms within the screening room and beds and drapes and all sorts of stuff. And it would hold 50 people. It's got giant Oscar statues in the foreground. And Scott's driving me crazy, snoring and then waking himself up. So I wake him up. I said, come on, let's get some fresh air. We go outside. We find the estate manager. I arrange for him to open up Michael's amusement park for us. And one of the highlights of my life is watching Scott Rudin on the merry-go-round on a little plastic horsey going up and down, trying not to laugh hysterically. So that was fun.
Yeah, that's
but
amazing.
Now the estate manager says, you know, it's going to still be some time before Michael gets here. And I go, gets here? Doesn't he live here? He goes, yes, but he's flying in from London and he should be here in a few hours. So he arranges for us to have some lunch, and he wheels out one of those hotel, you know, tables with the white, you know, tablecloth. And, you know, it's got two plates with two beautiful chrome domes. He's brings out two chairs from somewhere, you know, folding chairs. Rudin sits in one, I sit in the other, and then in sync, this man opens up the two domes, and I had a bowl of peanut M&Ms, and Scott Rudin had a Halloween fun-sized Kit Kat and Snicker bars. So that was our lunch. Michael eventually showed up several hours later. So it's now like probably 4 hours in total. We start to screen the movie. We're going to screen the movie, I think. And Michael says, well, I'll look at it, but thanks for coming. So then Paramount makes a deal. I guess he watched the movie at some point. And suddenly Michael has to leave the country. We don't know why. We don't know how. But he's off to Japan. And we ship the sets to him in Japan. And that's the last I knew about it.
Wow. Yeah, if you go on YouTube, look up Michael Jackson, Is It Scary? Because apparently that's like it's something that's said in the video, and you'll see the footage that was all shot for what would have been the video. And at the very end, there's a bookend with Wednesday and Pugsley and Pubert. And then if you go watch his actual official Ghost video, the longer version, which is like 23 minutes, you'll see that he just used the exact same concept, but without the Addams Family kids involved.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm glad you were on my podcast today.
Now, as I understand it, Addams Family Values was shot in 92, and that was before those allegations against Michael Jackson had surfaced. So where did the joke about Glicker being terrified of that Michael Jackson poster come from?
It happened way before any accusations, and it was just, we tried to make the room as creepy as possible with, you know, Disney, Disney posters and, you know, we are the, you know, everyone should unite. It was just every sort of creepy thing we, you know, cloying saccharine thing. Yeah. And we thought Michael Jackson would be a funny addition to that, but it had nothing to do with any molestation charges. We just got lucky on that one, I guess.
Yeah, because it worked on a totally different level when it's finally released.
Yeah, no, really.
So jumping to Men in Black, you have some amazing stories about working with Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. In fact, the title of your book is taken from a hilarious joke told by Jones that was kind of impromptu. I wondered if you could just tell our listeners about that moment.
Sure. The great thing about Tommy is he's not capable of making jokes per se. So here it is. It's Men in Black 2. It's middle of the night, we're in Los Angeles somewhere, probably on the Disney ranch shooting something. And Will Smith is sitting on one canvas chair. I'm next to him in another chair. And we call Tommy to the set because we're about ready to shoot. Tommy comes sitting down next to me and I abhor silence. Will Smith is always saying, Baz, leave me alone. You don't have to entertain me. Tame me, just sit here quietly. But I'm always chatting. So Tommy sits next to me. And for absolutely no reason that I can think of, I say to Tommy, Tommy, tell me why life is like a tampon. Now, not only did I not know I was going to say that, Tommy sure didn't know. This was, first time he's ever heard this question. And without any hesitation, Tommy says to me, "You know what, Barry? Life is like a tampon. You're always in the best possible place at the worst possible time." Will, I fell out of my chair. Will does a spit take. It was truly brilliant. Tommy is hilariously funny as long as he's not trying to be funny.
Yeah, I love hearing about that process of making sure that he just played it straight, because that's exactly what makes the dynamic between him and Will Smith work so brilliantly in that those movies.
Well, as you know, you only want one funny person in your comedy. It's what we were talking about with Kevin Kline. Kevin wanted to be funny, and Will was supposed to be funny, but we couldn't have both of them be funny. So Will had to be the straight man. But yes, you only want one funny guy, and that's the great thing about the Men in Black sequence series, which is that Tommy is the straight man once he realized that being the straight man often is where the bigger laugh comes in, which he didn't know until he saw the finished Men in Black, the first Men in Black.
Yeah. Now, you're not shy about your frustrations with Men in Black 2, along with Wild Wild West. You call it one of your biggest disappointments. I wanted to ask specifically because there's a long-standing behind-the-scenes detail about how the ending of Men in Black 2 had to be changed because 9/11 had happened. And I wondered if you could talk about that process and what the original ending would have entailed.
Right. There was a lot of stuff wrong with Men in Black 2. Some of it had to do with the ending, which takes place hurriedly on a roof set that we built at the last minute. That was supposed to take place between the two World Trade Centers
Okay.
buildings. In fact, when we were shooting Men in Black 2, the first two movies, Men in Black and Men in Black 2, we would go to New York, shoot for 3 or 4 weeks, shoot all the exteriors, and then go back to LA to shoot months of interiors, like Men in Black headquarters and the morgue and all that. So when we were in New York on Men in Black 2, I tried to find every place I could where you saw the World Trade Center in the background, knowing that the final scene was going to take place up there
Wow.
at the Trade Center. So in fact, when the 9/11 happened, we had to spend money going back through the sh stuff we shot in New York and erasing every shot, erasing the towers from every shot where you could see them. The shot was still there, but we just erased the towers. There were a lot of issues on that movie. I think some of the scenes are really, really funny, and I think that partially, I think it was a lack of chemistry between Will and Rosario Dawson. And I don't know why that's the case, but the love story, and I think partly it's my fault, is that I didn't lean into the love story and didn't lean into the loneliness of being a Men in Black agent, because you can never really have friendships or anything like that.
Right.
We delve into it much better on Men in Black 3, actually. But the other issue is that loneliness doesn't really make for great comedy, especially when Will's supposed to be the funny guy while Tommy Lee Jones is supposed to be the stoic guy.
Right.
So you have Will Smith being depressed about being an agent and being alone, but that's not funny. So there was this dichotomy between comedy and reality that just didn't work. The concept of the story, to a certain extent, wasn't good for the Men in Black series, I think.
Yeah. One thing that you didn't touch upon is in either book is that you directed the pilot for the Beverly Hills Cop TV series that didn't move forward.
I love that experience.
Yeah, I was curious. Yeah, if you could talk about what that was like and maybe what happened and why it didn't get picked up.
This will be in my third book. If everyone enjoys being on the toilet reading these chapters, so what happened was Sony and Paramount somehow jointly had the rights to a TV version of Beverly Hills Cop. I don't know how that happened, but Eddie Murphy agreed to be in it, and he wasn't going to be the lead. It was going to be about his son.
Right.
But Eddie was going to be in a couple of key scenes to A, sell that property. And then if it went to series, every couple of episodes, Eddie would show up when he felt like it, so we could make sure the audience was there for the show. So here's the issue. I loved working with Eddie. In fact, I went to Eddie's house. Arsenio Hall answered the phone, answered the door for some reason, and was in the meeting. But Eddie said, "Listen, if you think I'm going to do all those Eddie Murphy things, like oh, and all those other things, I'm not going to do any of that shit." And I said, "Okay, Eddie, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thanks. I'll see myself out." And he said, "That's the entire interview." And I said, "Well, I was going to talk to you about when we should do any key moments from the Beverly Hills Cops movies. But if you don't want to do any of those, there's really nothing to talk about. But thanks for your time." And
Wow.
I started to go. I'll see you on the set. I started to go. And he said, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yeah, sure, Eddie." And he said, "Why the fuck are you directing this thing?" And I said, "Well, I'm a big fan," I said. And I left, right? So it's the first day we're shooting, and I'm on the set with Eddie, and the scene is that we set up the scene, and then Eddie's supposed to pop up from behind the car, and Brandon, who played Eddie's son, is supposed to see him. And I would have hoped that Eddie would have gone, hee-hee-hee. So, but of course he said he wouldn't. So I roll camera. I'm curious what Eddie's going to do. I say, "Roll camera." Eddie stands up and goes, hee-hee-hee. And Eddie, the whole time, did everything I would have wanted him to do, but he said he wasn't going to do. And Eddie has two guys that work with him. One is his cousin, and one is his stunt double.
Okay.
And they both look identical to Eddie, but and can do every one of his mannerisms, have memorized the entire script, because Eddie likes to be in the master shot where you see him and set up the action and you know the rhythm, and he's great and hilarious and a born genius. And then you shoot, you know, an over the shoulder or a close up where he's in frame. But the whole rest of the scene, and he reverse angles over his shoulder onto the other actor's close up, anything where you don't actually need the Eddie Murphy, he's already gone home. So you shoot everything with Eddie in 2.5 hours and he's gone. But here's the thing, it was fine. There were several times where I would say to, I thought, Eddie Murphy, "You know what, Eddie? I don't think we need you for this shot." And the guy would say, "I'm not Eddie." That's how much they all looked, both his stand-in and his stunt guy. And they were both brilliant actors. And I wish I remembered their names, because it was amazing. Okay, so you wonder what happened. Two things happened. One, Brandon T.J. Jackson was not good enough to be the starring actor in that show. And in fact, there was one night where we were shooting a scene with Brandon and Eddie at a hotel where they're you know doing some reconnaissance. Eddie is hilarious. He's ad-libbing, he's riffing, and instead of Brandon letting Eddie go, he tries to compete with Eddie and interrupts him and says something funny. Again, comedy, one funny guy in the scene, one straight man in the scene. You've got Eddie Murphy being hilarious. The other guy better just shut up and react. And Brandon kept ruining takes. And I took him aside. I said, "Brandon, just listen to him and react. He's hilarious." He goes, "My fans don't want to see Eddie Murphy. They want to see Brandon T.J. Jackson." I said, "You know what? I have a feeling in this scene, they really want to see Eddie Murphy." Anyway, so that was one issue. The other issue is CBS and Paramount were both owned by the same Viacom conglomerate. The head of CBS, Les Moonves, was in a pissing contest with the head of Paramount, who was Tom Freston.
Gotcha.
Les Moonves literally didn't pick up the pilot called Beverly Hills Cop, co-starring Eddie Murphy, in part because of Brandon. And Eddie wasn't guaranteeing how much he would be in the series or not.
Right.
And I will say to Wes's, if you want to give Wes credit for anything, is that he didn't know if Eddie would be around enough. But it was really about not giving Tom Freston the hubris, the joy, the victory of having Eddie Murphy star in a television show. And we literally were not picked up. And it was a really, really good pilot.
Yeah, that actually also leaked online, and I was able to watch it. And it's a great pilot. It's really a bummer that we didn't get to see what it would turn into.
And Eddie was really good at it. And he was playing that guy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's my time, Barry. I appreciate you so much taking the time to talk with me. This book was hilarious and wonderful to read. And I hope that you do have another one that comes out, because I would love to hear more of your Hollywood stories.
Well, it's a pleasure working with you this, because you know so much about film, and my book is really sort of almost like a film school class in a way. Yeah. Well, thanks. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Barry. Hope you have a good one.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Hopefully everyone enjoyed that as much as I did. You can find much more about Barry Sonnenfeld's work at slashfilm.com. I will link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Don't be shy about that. Please leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. And tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you all tomorrow.
With Robinhood Gold, you don't need a silver spoon to eat up the financial favors of the 1%. Robinhood Gold allows a resourceful individual to earn the very liberal rate of 4.5% APY on uninvested cash, receive unlimited 1% deposit bonuses, and be rewarded with a handsome 3% retirement boost on an IRA account. Get the privileges of the high net worth for any net worth for just $5 a month. Sign up at Robinhood.com/gold. Terms apply. For product-specific disclosures, visit Robinhood.com/gold. Investing involves risk. Rate may change. Gold membership is offered by Robinhood Gold LLC.